at the same table with one of the greatest minds of our time, Professor Chomsky. It's really a wonderful honor. I promise you I'm not going to speak for very long. I've been asked to speak about how to confront empire. It's a huge question, and I have no easy answers. When we speak of confronting empire, we need to identify what empire means. Does it mean the US government and its European satellites, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and multinational corporations? Or does it mean more than that? In many countries, empire has sprouted other subsidiary heads, some dangerous byproducts, nationalism, religious bigotry, fascism, and of course, terrorism. All these march arm in arm with the project of corporate globalization. Let me illustrate what I mean. India, the world's biggest democracy, is currently at the forefront of the corporate globalization project. Its market of 1 billion people is being prized open by the WTO. Corporatization and privatization are being welcomed by the Indian government and the Indian elite. But it is not a coincidence that the Prime Minister, the Home Minister, the Disinvestment Minister, the men who signed the deal in India with Enron, the men who are selling the country's infrastructure to corporate multinationals, the men who want to privatize water, electricity, oil, coal, steel, health, education, and telecommunications, are all members or admirers of the RSS. The RSS is a right-wing, ultra-nationalist Hindu guild which has openly admired Hitler and his methods. The dismantling of democracy in India is proceeding with the speed and efficiency of a structural adjustment program. While the project of corporate globalization rips through people's lives in India, massive privatization and labor reform are pushing people off their land and out of their jobs. Hundreds of impoverished farmers are committing suicide by consuming pesticides. Reports of starvation deaths are coming in from all over the country. While the elite journeys to its imaginary destination, somewhere near the top of the world, the dispossessed are spiraling downwards into crime and chaos. This climate of frustration and national disillusionment is the perfect breeding ground, history tells us, for fascism. The two arms of the Indian government have evolved the perfect pincer action. While one arm is busy selling India off in chunks, the other, to divert attention, is orchestrating a howling, baying chorus of Hindu nationalism and religious fascism. It is conducting nuclear tests, rewriting history books, burning churches, demolishing mosques, censorship, surveillance, the suspension of civil liberties and human rights, the definition of who is an Indian citizen and who is not, particularly with regard to Muslim people, is becoming common practice now. Last March, in the state of Gujarat, 2,000 Muslims were butchered in a state-sponsored pogrom. Muslim women were specially targeted. They were stripped and gang-raped before being burned alive. Arsonists burned and looted shops, homes, textile mills, and mosques. More than 150,000 Muslims have been driven from their homes. The economic base Muslim community has been devastated. While Gujarat burned, the Indian Prime Minister was on MTV promoting his new film. In January this year, the government that orchestrated the killing was voted back into office with a comfortable majority. Nobody has been punished for the genocide. Narendra Modi, architect of the pogrom, proud member of the RSS, has embarked on his second term as the Chief Minister of Gujarat. If he were Saddam Hussein, of course, each atrocity would have been on CNN. But since he is not, and since the Indian market is open to global investors, the massacre is not even an embarrassing inconvenience. There are more. Barriers. The free market does not threaten national sovereignty, it undermines democracy. As the disparity between the rich and the poor grows, the fight to corner resources is intensifying. To push through their sweetheart deals, to corporatize the crops we grow, the water we drink, the air we breathe, and the dreams we dream. Corporate globalization needs an international confederation of loyal, corrupt, authoritarian governments in poorer countries to push through unpopular reform and quell the mutiny. Corporate globalization, or shall we call it by its name, imperialism, needs a press that pretends to be free. It needs courts that pretend to dispense justice. Meanwhile, the countries of the North harden their borders and stockpile weapons of mass destruction. After all, they have to make sure that it's only money, goods, patents, and services that are globalized, not the free movement of people, not a respect for human rights, not international treaties on racial discrimination. Not treaties on chemical and nuclear weapons, or greenhouse gas emissions, or climate change, or, God forbid, justice. So this, all this is empire, this loyal confederation, this obscene accumulation of power, this greatly increased distance between those who make the decisions and those who have to suffer them. Our fight, our goal, our vision for another world must be to eliminate that distance. The good news is that we're not doing too badly. There have been major victories. Here in Latin America, you have had so many. In Bolivia, you had Cochabamba. In Peru, there was the uprising in Arequipa. In Venezuela, President Hugo Chavez is holding on despite. Despite the US government's best efforts. And the world's gaze is on the people of Argentina who are trying to refashion their country from the ashes of the havoc wrought by the IMF. gathering momentum and is poised to become the only real political force to counter religious fascism. And as the corporate globalization glittering ambassadors, Enron, Bechtel, WorldCom, Arthur Andersen, where were they last year and where are they now? And of course, here in Brazil, we must ask, who was the president last year and who is it now?
Nobody doubts that Saddam Hussein is a ruthless dictator, a murderer,
whose words acceptance was supported by the government of the United States and Great Britain. There is no doubt that Iraqis would be better off without him. But then the whole world would be better off without a certain Mr. Bush.
Another world is not only possible,
She's on her way, and on a quiet day. If you listen very carefully, you can hear her breathing.